This is the Oil and Gas Startups Podcast, where we showcase emerging technology and the stories of industry founders, investors, and leaders with your hosts, Jake Corley and Colin McClelland.
What is going on, Wildcatters? Welcome back to another episode. I think it's my first recording of 2024, if I'm being honest. We're like 2 weeks in. We have such a backlog. So did you guys have a good holiday season?
I had a great holiday season. I just kind of stuck around, which is atypical for us and our family. But
yeah,
I'm just happy to stay in Houston and not have too much to do.
That's awesome. So we are sitting here with Philip and Roxana from Invana. What is Invana? It's not Encana, but it's Invana.
Yeah.
So Invana is a digital software solution for emissions management. We're a SaaS company. We actually started at Halliburton. Incubated there.
Did you work at Halliburton?
Yes, I did. I've been in oil and gas for over 20 years now, primarily at service companies. But for the last 9 years, I was at Halliburton before I came over to Invana. And there, my career's mostly been in technology development, software, but I started as a mechanical engineer. In 2019, I became director of stewardship and sustainability for Halliburton.
Said stewardship and sustainability?
Yeah, so that included...
That's an interesting title. What is...
Yeah, you know, I had to look it up too. So stewardship really was around the regulatory and compliance aspects of environmental and chemicals. It's really a great role. I mean, to learn more about the overall aspects of working at a company like a big company like Halliburton and all the things that go into it. I mean, nothing teaches you more about a company than going through the value chain, which you need to do to understand the sustainability aspects, all the ESG aspects. So it was a new role for me. And luckily I got to work with some very talented people who taught me a lot about sustainability. In that role, I was responsible for everything from helping to set our targets. It was the first time we set reduction targets at Halliburton, to putting out our ASR, which is our annual and sustainability report. So helping to get all the metrics on the ESG side, calculating everything, helping to lead our steering committee on sustainability topics. So it was a really great role. And one of the big things that was really obvious is that there's not really any good solutions in the market, or there weren't at the time, to help us with getting a handle on our emissions. And emissions was such a hot topic in that period of time. So luckily, Landmark, which is the commercial software division at Halliburton, their leadership team was very interested in getting into this sustainability space and incubating products in that area. So we got together and we started thinking about what kind of products would help oil and gas companies manage their emissions. And that's really where Invana was born.
So was this incubated, was like the idea and stuff purely from like, it was from the business side and with Landmark? Did you guys interface with like Halliburton Labs at all in this, or was this totally different?
So Halliburton Labs was being born around the same time. Yeah. So yeah, it was a little bit independent at the time. And Halliburton Labs was really focusing on companies that had hardware and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, this was purely digital play.
Okay, so you came up with this idea, and then did y'all decide that this was going to be a company from the beginning, or was this just a internal project of like, can we scratch our own itch, and then if we can, we go out and we spin this off and we like commercialize it?
So we wanted to treat this like a startup within Halliburton. So it was a little bit different. I don't think we'd really done anything like that before. From the beginning, there was an intention of treating it like it could be something that spun off. And certainly we took advantage of having the use case from Halliburton, but we also looked externally a lot because we wanted to make something that would be relevant to all oil and gas companies and not just for us.
So it's not built just for oilfield service companies. This is built for E&Ps as well.
E&Ps and
midstream companies.
Yes. And honestly, we could expand beyond oil and gas. It's flexible enough for that. Yeah.
So walk me through, what is the main problem that I'm solving? Is this to understand the scope of your current emissions and to quantify that and put that into more of, like, is the output like a regulatory style report of like, hey, here's all of our emissions for all of Halliburton, and that's what it comes into?
So the intention is to help with all of that as well. But like, if you think about the emissions management space, you've got everything from identification and quantification of your emissions, which is a not as trivial as it may sound. And yes, we cover that aspect so you can help model your emissions or take in measurement data to bring in your quantified emissions. But then from there, you have to think about reduction possibilities. So scenario modeling, what happens if, how do you even set reduction targets? How do you track that you're actually achieving them? How do you put together a roadmap for that? How do you manage different levels of maturity within your organization? So in some places, you may have all the data you need. Most companies don't. But if you do have data, great. We can take that and help you turn that into an emissions quantification. If you don't have data and you need to make assumptions, we can help you with that as well. So we have different models, and in different parts of your business, you may be doing different things, and you can track all of that and help get to the maturity level you want to be at for modeling your emissions and for planning how you're going to reduce or offset eventually. So all the things around that wheel, whether it's identification, quantification, reduction, which are those step changes up to 25%, maybe reduction, elimination or carbon capture and storage or other types of credits to offset. And then you're back at the beginning, kind of going down this wheel. So kind of management tools and understanding how to how you can actually make better decisions. Mm-hmm. People are starting to consider the carbon impact in addition to financial impact. And actually the carbon impact now has a financial impact, which is part of the story. So that's part of why people are caring about this now. So really our goal is to help people make better decisions and then be in a position to track how those decisions are playing out.
An important thing around this too is the auditability and governance of it. A lot of companies are making bold claims for, I'm going to be net zero by 2030 or 2050, or I have this target by 2030 or 2050.
It's totally arbitrary. It's just like, let's pick a date and throw a dart there.
And so when you're making business decisions on a day-to-day, week-to-week, quarter-to-quarter basis, you need to know where you are on that journey based on all my emissions that I have, any sort of offsets or impacts that I have, to know, okay, it's 2024 right now. I have this far to go until I'm net zero. What do I need to do? What changes do I need to make to reach that journey?
How do you guys handle, let's assume, a new pack of new regulations, like a new Inflation Reduction Act comes out and there's major implications for all of your customers?
Yeah, no, that's a big thing that's happening right now, right? So Inflation Reduction Act, the new Quad OB, Quad OC rules, and then the revisions that are supposed to come out to EPA reporting subpart W are all things that are top of mind of our customers right now. And what Roxanne has done with the product and the team has done with the product has made this incredibly modular. We don't just serve US clients, we serve clients internationally. Part of being a partner with Halliburton in this, and we can talk a little bit about how that works with us, but part of being a partner with Halliburton is we're serving customers in Southeast Asia, in the North Sea, all in different regulatory or voluntary initiative environments. And so the way that the software is built is very modular for this. So we build out all the emission profiles, all the emission sources that you could have. And then we can just simply change, are we reporting this for EPA? Are we reporting this for API, compendium, whatever that may be? We can kind of seamlessly translate that, because some companies in the same company may have to report to three or four different voluntary regulatory regimes. So having that modularity in it is key to kind of having a scalable and governable product.
So let's talk about, because I think it differs widely from stateside versus like internationally, because I think you mentioned like it's kind of, I think it's a lot of like voluntarily electing into controlling those things rather than a strict regulatory environment, as we may be seeing here in kind of the US. Let's just look at companies that because you're on the business development side, right? So you're client facing. What is the number one thing that is currently top of mind with the companies that you're interfacing with?
Yeah, so in these conversations, in the US, it is those three regulations that I talked about. Okay. The IRA, so the Inflation Reduction Act came in 2022 and mandated some serious changes in how emissions are, how leak detection and repair happens. So that's through Quad OB and Quad OC. And then how emissions are reported, which is subpart W. So the IRA bill came in and said, hey, EPA, you have to make changes to these rules. So the first that actually came into law was through Quad OB and Quad OC. So previously, what oil and gas companies were having to do through Quad OA, which came into effect about 2026, is, hey, twice a year, any site that had that was built after 2016, you had to shoot that with an OGI camera twice a year, mm-hmm. find and fix those leaks. Pretty simple. Quad OB now states, okay, now any sites built after 2022, you have to shoot those four times a year. But then it added some key things into there too. So it added the super emitter rule. So now third parties such as the, so third party NGOs like the EDF, the EPA, et cetera, are allowed to find and report emissions over 100 kilograms an hour. So roughly 75 MCF a day. So if those are seen by a third party, those can be reported to the EPA, which then affects your subpart W submission, which now affects the new methane tax coming from the IRA. So
is that in effect or is that coming down the pipe?
So the methane tax is in effect.
Okay.
Starting next, I guess we're in 2024 now. So starting in 2024 and it scales each subsequent year going to 2027.
Let's expand upon that.
Yeah. So yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So again, going back to the three rules, how they all kind of affect the methane tax. So the IRA basically said there's a methane tax now. Anything that, which the EPA defines the facility, not how you and I would kind of think of facility. A facility is like a sub basin or a grouping of facilities or, you know, someone's activity in the Permian Basin or Midland Basin. Any ton of CO2 above, I believe it's 25,000 megatons of CO2e emitted is now subject to a fine. So starting this year, it's $900 per ton. I believe next year it escalates to $1,200 per ton for a couple of years. And then after 2027, it's $1,500 per ton.
And so let's contextualize that. What does that mean with like an average independent operator?
Yeah, we've talked to some clients, an average independent operator, it's millions of dollars.
Yeah.
It's millions of dollars. And now, so this is based off of now the current subpart W rules, which the new subpart W rules come into effect, which subpart W is what operators use to report in their emissions. Are expected to increase emissions reported by 1.5 to 2 times. So you can imagine not only did the fees go up, but the reporting is becoming more stringent, which needed to happen. You know, it's been pretty well scientifically proven that what is being reported now in subpart W is just lower than what's actually happening, what's actually seeing out there. So they added some new emission factors into the subpart W proposal. They're adding in outside leak events. So if you have a leak and you have data on that and that's captured, you have to report that now. And all sorts of kind of other more data-driven metrics to refine what's reported. Now, with the new super emitter rule coming in, if somebody sees a leak that you've had, that affects what's being reported on your subpart W report now. So let's say EDF has a satellite that sees 100 kilogram an hour emission on someone's site. So now they have to report that based on the best data they have. So if they're only seeing that site quarterly, they now have to go back to the last scan, extrapolate that 100 kilograms an hour and report that on their subpart W report, which affects their methane tax. So this has very huge implications for operators. And potentially really large fees that they're going to have to pay. So if you don't have a handle of everything that's happening on your emissions front, there's a lot of fines and fees in the US that you have to pay.
So you said one of the comments that you made was that what is currently kind of being reported is probably not accurate with what's actually, and is that due to measurement? Is it like a lack of technology? Is it a lack of operators implementing the technology? Like, why does that exist?
Yeah.
So typically in the past, methane emissions were reported with a straight emissions factor. So I think there was some analysis done at one point and they just said, you can just report X emissions per day for this piece of equipment. And if you have 10 of those, then you multiply by 10 in the number of days.
So every piece of equipment had an emissions factor.
Yeah. Just pneumatic valves, easy math. Yeah. Separators. And that's still part of the case, which is in the new subpart W revisions. But those factors have now been changed in some cases. Some cases you're required to use what they call data-driven or engineered factors, where you actually have to use real data from your site to create that factor. And then now adding in leaks as well too, you have to take in the data from leaks, which that's more directly measured data.
Okay. So there is no, for you guys, there is no hardware component to this. You're going to be plugging into either existing sensors or sensors that they're bringing in, or data that is tied to some sort of like
data.
Detection.
Yeah, or operational data.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I mean, part of the challenge is that detection technology isn't necessarily great at quantification today. Generally, they're measuring concentration, which doesn't give you a quantity of methane that's actually been leaked. There's no flow rates or anything like that would make it easier to quantify. So that makes it, it's a big data science exercise to try and figure out how much methane you actually leaked. So that's where a lot of the challenge comes in.
So when you're talking to a company and you know you're in this process of evaluation, are most of the companies that you're talking to, do they already have a lot of the sensors, and do they already have like a grasp on the detection side? Or is it like, hey, we need to do this, and you're like, well, how are we going to do it? And then you have to go back and get all the sensors.
Yeah, great question. So again, kind of going back to US versus international, so we kind of span across all that, US has had a pretty good handle on the sensors, flyovers, satellites, everything in that. And companies generally use who they like when it comes to there. And our idea is, to be fairly agnostic with that. Internationally, we're seeing more people coming to us kind of saying, hey, help us out, help us figure this out. We don't really know what to use, what's going on. We signed up for this voluntary initiative and we have this regulation coming down the pipe. Please help us out with this. And that's where we're kind of interfacing a little more with that. But going back to both customers, it comes down to, it's just a lot of data that you have to put into one spot and connect into, whether it be the sensors, the operational data, the data that you'd have in things such as WellView or your production system, that all kind of add up to the total numbers. And when we, at Envato, we're not just looking at methane.
That's right.
We take in data from drilling activity, from cementing, from completions activity. We're really focused on providing an entire picture of CO2, not just methane. Methane is talked about a lot because it is a big problem. And it is the one that the industry thinks that we can fix the easiest, which I agree. But there's other things that add up into your CO2.
Is it the emissions factor with those types of activities? Like, how do you quantify those things?
Yeah.
Well, that's the trick, right? So there's any number of ways you could do it. So say you know exactly how much fuel was used and it's an activity that combusts fuel. You can use that, of course. That's great if you have it, especially if you have it by which piece of equipment did it and what it was for and why it was used. If you don't have that, then you can use things like, well, how long was the equipment running? And you can make some assumptions. So there's a bunch of different ways to model. And again, it depends on what level of data the company has access to and how they're tracking it. Because most companies weren't tracking all this data for the purpose of emissions, right? They might have the data for other reasons. Maybe they wanted to improve the reliability of the equipment, so they were tracking things for that reason. So really what we're trying to do is help companies use the data they have to model the emissions the best way they can, and to also give them a view into what the options are if they wanted to change that or improve that. And by doing this, we can help a company understand how their specific business operations impact their emissions, right? Instead of just this top-down view of you have this total number, you can say, oh, well, in this area, doing these things, this is what we produce. And that lets you really understand where you can make the most impact with reductions, where the easiest impacts are, where the hardest ones are, and those kinds of things. So plus it makes it a lot simpler transferring data between different departments, right? A lot of times there's a small, tiny group that's trying to calculate emissions and they're trying to get data from all these different places and different departments and different areas. And it's all Excel spreadsheets. And again, the data has to be transformed so many different ways. So by doing direct integration and having that passed through these integrations and doing the modeling centrally on our side in a way that's governed by a sustainability team, it keeps the calculations consistent. It keeps people from having to email or dump the data put it through some calculation in Excel and then pass it. It keeps everything flowing a lot more neatly and with less error.
Yeah.
On that note, who really quickly, who are the end users? Like, who are the people actually logging into the platform at a company?
Yeah. So typically it's the sustainability teams, the SMEs that are keeping watch over their particular areas. It's management looking at dashboards. So a lot of times the folks that in the past had to provide all this data to those teams that are trying to track it, they don't necessarily need to do that anymore because it's all handled through automation. But say there's a vertical within the company and they've been set a target, you know, they can now track that and see how they're doing in their particular area. So it kind of runs the gamut depending on the company and how they've chosen to use the system. But typically it's people who are trying to see, okay, how are we doing? What are, you know, where are we seeing spikes or those kind of challenges? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, like I can say with someone with an upstream background, what I like seeing too is we see more and more of the operations teams using it because they're getting mandates from the sustainability side saying these are the targets we have to make, but we're not going to tell you how to make them. You know, you run your operation to do it. So again, having the gambit of drilling all the way through completion production, those teams can see where they're impacting that number the most and make the decisions themselves on how to do it. Part of one of the great things about this software being built in one of the largest service companies in the world is that we're able to think through every single piece when we built the software that can contribute to that. So that could be as simple as a drilling engineer changing out their mud system, changing out their cement to a lower scope 3 cement, all the way to the procurement teams finding companies that have lower emissions, because that directly impacts their scope 3 emissions. So there's a lot of different ways that this gets used throughout the company, and it's exciting now starting to see the operations team start to use it.
So, okay, so you guys come in, you plug into the existing sensors, and now you're pulling in all this information. Are there running, like I think you said, they're running scenarios on kind of if we change this or if we don't change this, here's kind of what we're looking at. And does that run into the regulations that we just talked about and then spit out like, if you don't do these things, now you're going to pay $5 million?
So when we talk about the regulations,
I'm just trying to visualize
it. Yeah. So going back to those regulations, you know, the way this looks like for someone in the US having to deal with these regulations, typically all methane mostly comes down to the production team or the facilities design team. So yeah, an instance of a scenario model for that, a fairly easy instance is, we're able to see, okay, I have this many pneumatic valves. If I spend this much money to place my pneumatic valves, so you've seen companies like EQT and others.
$25 million to replace pneumatic valves. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you can actually see directly in our software, if I do that, how does this affect my bottom, not only my bottom line, but how does this affect my CO2e now?
Yeah.
So what changes do I need to make next to affect that? You know, is if it's flaring, for instance, flaring is a big part of a lot of our customers' CO2e. We can dive in and drill down, where am I flaring the most, all the way down to the asset level. And, you know, if I need to make a capital investment so that I'm flaring less, how does that affect my CO2e? So it's every part of the operation that we allow someone to dive into to determine how does this affect my total company scope 1, scope 2, scope 3 emissions, and, you know, how do my changes impact it?
So on the... You just made me think of this. I'm kind of curious if y'all interface with this at all. Somebody who's just got like just tons of stranded gas and they're flaring. Do y'all interface with any of these companies that are doing Bitcoin mining, or does that come up in these conversations?
You know, that hasn't come up in any of our conversations yet. I mean, that's something we'd absolutely love to explore, though. I mean, because again, we want to be able to hand our customer solutions. And
yeah.
Part of our board's vision and our company's vision of Envana is to be a total carbon solution. So being able, a big way that we're going to do this and grow this is through partnerships with other companies such as that. So
let's talk more about that after we get off the podcast.
For sure. Yeah, let's do it. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to. I also handle partnerships with the company. So yeah, I'm your guy. But it's really, as Roxanna stated, we've only really been a company since January. I started last January. I started in June, and for a while it was just Roxanna and another one of our employees, Emily Rees, who was running the show. And we've grown from 2 employees all the way to, I think we're at 20 now.
Almost, I think.
And, wow. And continuing to grow. And that's not including the contract employees that we have. So Halliburton and our private equity partner have made very serious commitments to see us grow and see this be a powerhouse in emissions management. And we've been able to hire some great folks to the team to help grow that. We have an awesome sales force. A very stellar product management staff underneath Roxana, and an operations team as well. That and we're hiring too.
We're hiring, please. Yeah, if you're interested.
You don't know any positions off the top of your head? We can just spit them out.
So I'm hiring on the dev team, the data science team. We're hiring some SMEs on the GHD side all over. We've got
developers front and back end.
Yeah,
looking to grow that staff and support. I'll be hiring an analyst for my team later this year. I mean, we're committed to grow and help tackle this problem globally.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So one of the things that I'm curious about is how do you either interface with or do you or not? There are these groups out there that are like this like certification on how well you have a grip on your emissions, like MIQs and the Project Canaries. Does y'all stuff go into any sort of like any of that or any like rating systems or?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's something we've been thinking a lot about as a company. You know, where do we fit in this space? Because in the whole emissions management space, even still, it's a very big carrot and stick with a lot of companies, you know. Saving money or spending money to put in an emission software just still isn't as fun as drilling a new well.
I don't think anything's as fun as drilling a well.
So yeah, it not much is. How are you providing incentives to have this data? Because it is so important, so critical to these companies right now. And I think differentiated gas is an interesting space for that. And we're still thinking through this, but our philosophy around it is we just want to help enable it. We don't ever plan to come in and tell people what differentiated gas is. We'll leave that to the government or
it's controversial.
Yeah,
it is very controversial depending on who you talk to.
Yeah, we don't really feel like that's our space, but if we have clients that want to use it, we're more than able to produce the data that's required to enable it.
Yeah,
and to provide it to auditors or whoever else. Like part of what we're building into the product is that transparency and auditability, and that ability to easily see how were these quantified and where did the data come from, so that we can enable any kind of certification or audit or assurance that a customer may want to have.
Yeah. The critiques, and I don't know if y'all have heard this or not, but I have. The critiques of things like that where it's third-party certifications is that it's a goalpost that continually moves.
Exactly. And even if
it's like, well, we spend all this money, we play this game, we get an A rating, and then all of a sudden, 5 months later, we're at a D-, and it's like, we got to spend another $25 million to get back to an
exactly.
A.
Exactly. Well, it's really from my observation is that in these kind of more marketplace scenarios, the market's just really not mature enough where if I just have a certificate thrown on a marketplace, it'll garner a good premium for it. Where you're seeing it be most successful in kind of these bilateral agreements where a producer agrees with end user that will provide you differentiated gas for X price. And that's where I see it. I have seen it work the most. So that's why we want to just be facilitators of it.
Are people selling differentiated gas? Is that like, significant traction in the market to say that that's a thing and not just
no, it's like definitely a thing. It's definitely a thing. People are selling differentiated gas for 5 to 12 cent premiums is typically what I hear. The problem still is that it's a bit of the Wild West. And the Biden administration has been pretty clear that they're not going to make rules for differentiated gas because they tend to think that encourages more differentiated gas, which that side of the aisle, I think, is just not wanting to encourage natural gas production anyway. So, but what is a fact and what is true is that the Department of Fossil Energy is working with a group of international stakeholders now to determine globally what is differentiated gas. What are the metrics for it? And I think there is a standard that's being worked towards globally because if you think about it, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. I mean, it's a very kind of market-driven capitalist approach to, again, have that carrot to encourage people.
How would you define that today, or how's the market defining differentiated gas today? Let's just say stateside.
Yeah. So I may go down a little bit of rabbit hole, I apologize. Yeah. But so if I'm an end user, so let's say I'm a automaker. And I buy natural gas to power my plant. That natural gas that I buy is a scope 3 emissions. The emissions that were produced to make that natural gas that gets to my plant was a scope 3 emission for me. And typically what people use to calculate that now there's a couple different standards. I believe there's a GREET standard, and then there's the UK DEFRA standard that basically just assumes, okay, you know, every MMBTU of gas that you buy, think it's around like 11 kilograms of methane were produced from it. Don't quote me on it, but around that. So differentiated gas, you're able to prove to that end user now, this is what actually were the CO2 emissions or the methane emissions produced from that, which typically in most cases is much lower than that standard. So now the end user can have a lower scope 3 emission by buying this. I can actually prove auditably this is what the emissions were from this gas.
It's like organic gas.
Organic gas, exactly. but it's a way for typically it's those end users that have the pressure right now for scope 3 emissions.
Yeah.
And it's a way for them to lower their scope 3 emissions without having to pay for offsets or anything like that.
So let's talk about that. Like with the offsets / carbon credits, how does that play into the platform for clients?
Yeah. So the idea is if you've set some goals and you need to reduce, and you know, you're never going to get to zero if you're actually doing things unless you manage to completely just go renewable and your products you're using are somehow also zero emission. So most companies are going to have to do some kind of offset or start doing carbon capture and storage and those kinds of things. So we want to help companies track that and plan for it and see how that will work in their bottom line.
Isn't the offset market still very much the wild, wild west?
Yeah, like,
from what I've heard is that like it's sketchy, like the early days of the internet, to where you're paying all this money for these offsets and essentially you're getting like a PDF in your email saying, yeah, you bought these offsets. Like there is no database built on blockchain that is like a ledger. Yeah. You can see like what's what or if it's legit or certified.
There are companies doing blockchain carbon, but again, it is the Wild West. And that's why we again, don't want to be claiming that something is a valid credit or not, right? But if a company has determined internally that this is a valid credit and they want to use this, then we will help them track that.
Maybe y'all know the answer to this. How are offsets created?
There's a multitude of ways that offsets are created.
Okay, let's go through a few examples. Now I'm curious, because I'm like, what if I was just like, hey, I'm just selling offsets on the internet? Like,
yeah.
And how do you know that it is what it is?
There are what are similar to accounting standards for offset creation.
Okay.
So the American Carbon Registry is probably the most prominent one that I know of. That basically they set, just like you have GAAP standards for your books, they set standards for carbon accounting. So you'll hear things referred to as nature-based offsets. And again, I'm no expert in this space, but nature-based offsets are kind of, you know, hey, we'll plant trees to offset that. And there's a way that is calculated and tracked and that the American Carbon Registry puts forward. Where our industry, oil and gas industry, has really kind of decided they're going to make their ground in offsets is through sequestration, so carbon capture and storage. Which makes a ton of sense, right? I mean, our industry has a history through CO2 floods of putting CO2 back.
We've already been doing this.
We've been doing it for a long time, and there's plenty of great depleted reservoirs out there too that can hold CO2. And there's a lot of nuances to it, but I think that's where you're going to see at least our industry lean the most towards in the offset market is through sequestration. And back to the product and how that all fits in is that, you know, if we're giving a company a picture of their entire emissions, scope 1, scope 2, scope 3, part of our product is going to be bringing in that data from however they're doing it because what we're doing now is showing everything how it adds up.
Yeah.
And then that's the subtraction to get you to whatever your goal you're going towards.
So essentially, like you get there and it's like you're balancing this out. It's like, hey, here's how many you need. And so... Is that integrated into the platform, or they go outside and then they just buy those and then they balance it out and say, hey, we got to as close to zero as possible.
These are goals.
Yeah.
One day. Yeah.
This is all, that's all the roadmap right now, but.
Yeah.
You know what should be the biggest offset is whales. Somebody needs to get back in. Whales are like equal to like, I think it's like 700,000 trees or something.
I've never known that. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Google it. It's crazy. We talk about it here all the time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Because we killed the whale population like 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And so.
Bring whaling back?
Just bring like whale breeding back. Just let all these whales free because it's. Well, I can go down a long rabbit hole on this, but whales are where it's at when it comes to offsets. Nice. So I'm surprised we haven't seen some like venture-packed billion-dollar startup that's just like, yeah, we're just whale breeding and start just like here. Selling offsets. We may have to. Digital Wildcatters Whaling.
And any of digital your oil and gas partners, we'll bring that into Invana and they can have that offset it. So.
That's right.
Hey, I think this sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Anything? One question, this is a little bit of a curveball question. But what would y'all say is the Invana difference? And I mean that by there's a lot of people entering this space.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. A lot of people that are entering the space and every aspect of the life cycle of the problem that we're solving here.
Yeah.
What is y'all's differentiating factor in the market?
Definitely. And I'll answer this and then I'll let Roxana have her answer too. But for someone who didn't build this product like Roxana did and you know, has spent my career in oil and gas. I think for me, the biggest difference that I've seen at Invana is we're an oil and gas product made by the oil and gas industry. We're built within Halliburton, leveraging their 100+ years of experience. And rightfully so, Halliburton made the decision, you know, hey, in order for this thing to flourish, we need to pull this out of this large company and make its own thing. So Halliburton still owns half the company. The other half of the company is owned by a private equity company called Sigler Guff out of New York, large private equity company with a great energy practice. And the key differentiation is that we are leveraging heavily that oil and gas experience to build this product. You know, we're not a company out of Silicon Valley that's looking kind of for an opportunistic way to enter into a lucrative industry. We're building this on the back of hundreds of years of experience, 100 years experience in oil and gas. And I think that's key when you build these products is to be able to know the customer experience.
It's trust. Right?
It's trust.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's staying power, knowing that we're going to be here. And one of the things that amazed me too, just from the, not so much how we're differentiating to the market, but differentiating really to other products is that we partner with Halliburton and we're able to leverage that presence globally. Many startups can't talk to some of the largest companies throughout the world. And we have that ability to with our partnership. So, but outside of that, you know, I think how Roxana has built the product to be just so incredibly modular, to plug and play in any sort of regulatory scenario, any sort of region with across drilling, completions, production, all the way through P&A. Is a real key difference maker to this project. We're not just a methane-focused product. We focus on the entire CO2 experience.
All right. First off, I did not build this product by myself. I just want to say that.
Pretty much.
She's over here just hacking away a little Mark Zuckerberg.
It's a very talented team of people that help out with this and built it. So I agree with everything you just said. Being part of oil and gas is a really big part of this. I think our approach is that we're not just targeting one type of user within an E&P company or a services company. We're trying to help bring all the different departments together, right? So the sustainability team, the drilling team, the operations production upstream teams, downstream teams, we want to bring them all together and provide a platform that they can all use. Where I think some of these other products are very niche, focusing on just production or just drilling or just methane or just, you know, so we want to really provide a platform where the sustainability team feels like they have control and governance over how things are being done. But then all the other teams can contribute data either through their software or databases or through their people and then also see how things are going across the company. And our ability to operationalize the understanding of emissions. And what I mean by that is that we can tie it back to activities, whatever granular level is really going to help make a difference when people are trying to make decisions and track and see what's going on.
I love it. Those are great answers. I was curious what the answer was going to be. That's good. Yeah. That was good. Yeah. Well, awesome guys. Where can people find you guys? Somebody wants to reach out, they're listening, they're like, I need to see Invana.
Yeah. We have a website at www.invana.com.
Yeah.
So you feel free to do that. You can reach us on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. Philip's on LinkedIn. Happy to chat. And like I said, we're hiring. So please reach out.
Do you
out.
Have a profile on Collide Pro yet?
We don't. But
right, we'll make that happen.
Let's do it.
So if you're a Collide Pro subscriber, you can go in there, check them out as well. We'll get your jobs listed on Collide as well. We'll make that happen.
That'd be awesome. Great.
Get y'all some new people, some top talent.
We'd love that.
This has been great, guys.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
thanks for coming awesome.
Thanks for having us here today. We appreciate it.
All right, guys, take 2 seconds, share this with all your friends, and we'll catch you on the next episode.